unsurpassed, penetrating and perfect Dharma is he met with even 100,000 million kalpas, having it to see and listen to remember and accept. I vow to taste the truth of the Tathagata's words. Hi. Hello. My name is Victor. Wow. And Les is not here today, as you might have noticed. So I'm giving the talk. So the title of the talk is Doing Nothing. So there is a saying, don't just sit there, do something. A Zen friend of mine said, the saying should be, don't just do something, sit there. I used to think that was a joke, but actually it is, I think it's quite profound. Doing nothing in its broadest sense, whether we are sitting, lying down or standing, or even moving, is the core of our practice. Of course, we are never actually doing nothing, even if our bodies are still. Our lungs are breathing, our hearts are beating, our eyes are blinking. So what do we mean by doing nothing? When I say doing nothing, I do not mean, as most people do, just zoning out or vegetating. By the way, can everybody hear me?
Yes.
Raise your hand if you can't hear me at any time. So zoning out or vegetating is not doing nothing. It is actually letting the mind take over and do its thing. It is actually a passive activity when you zone out. Zoning out is automatic thinking and not recommended in Zen circles. So true doing nothing is actually very active. Doing nothing means doing as little as possible, but especially not thinking. In its broader sense, doing nothing means only doing what is actually required for the activity. In other words, do not think unless it is a thinking activity, and do not do extra unwanted movement of the body. When Steph Curry, this is a famous basketball player, some of you might have heard of him, when he's playing well, I don't know, but I'm pretty sure there's virtually no thought. And all that's happening is just action that is required. I think he is in a kind of a dance with the way the world occurs to him. So the world occurs in a certain way. People are moving in a certain way. And probably, because he's a great basketball player, it occurs in a very slow motion for him when he's really playing well. You can see what people are going to do, and it occurs in slow motion. Although things are happening very rapidly in a few, just microseconds. So I think he's in a kind of kind of a dance with the way the world occurs for him. And his whole body just seems to flow. I like sports analogies because in sport, there is no time or very little time for thinking. I don't think you can really play sport well and be thinking a lot. There's only time for action in sport. One way to not think is to intentionally refocus ourselves away from our thoughts, where our attention is the vast majority of the time, and onto something else. Now, the something else that we focus on in Soto Zen meditation is the body and or the breath. This meditation is called Shikantaza, which means just sitting. So to actually just sit is very difficult. So we start out by focusing on our body and our breath. Just sitting means exactly that. You're just sitting. There's no thought or movement. So when we try to focus on our breath in Shikantaza, the thinking mind is there and it thinks you want it to do something. So it tries to control the breath and your breath does not feel natural. Or it will hum to the breath. The mind cannot let go. True Shikantaza would actually go beyond focusing on our breath and body. Focusing on our body and breath is still doing something. True shikantaza is true doing nothing. Or rather, more accurately, nobody is doing. I was recently at a week-long retreat, and the teacher told me to not do anything on the breaks. At this retreat, we had hour-long breaks after every meal, and smaller breaks at various times during the day. He said that most people want to fill up the breaks with some activity, even though there was nothing we had to do. People would do yoga, go for walks, exercise, chat. That's not really allowed. Well, up until he said that to me, I had been doing just that. I had been scheming and carrying out my schemes of doing various activities to fill up the breaks. I'd actually been worried about how I was going to fill up the time. I was irritated that the breaks were too long. I was used to Canon Do breaks, they're about 10 minutes. Anyway, just kidding. From then on, during the breaks, I relaxed. If there was nothing obvious to do, such as a shower or get a little exercise, I just sat on the nearest chair and meditated, kind of like a cat, you know, like a dog. You know, you're just sitting there, I don't know what to do, I'll just sit down. So, but this is how human beings are, especially in the West. We have to fill up the day with activities. I'm sure many of us have had the experience of accomplishing a tremendous amount during the day, and at the end of the day, we do not feel that happy. I always find that very annoying. Like, I've put on all this effort, I've done all these things, I checked off every single thing, and at the end of the day, it's like, oh, feels good. Society tells us that to be happy, we have to accomplish, to be busy. But true happiness and accomplishment are not that related. I'm not quite sure how they're related, but it's not. I don't think there's too much relationship between the two. There is some. Many of us feel incredibly stressed from this continual drive to accomplish. At the end of this week-long retreat, in which I accomplished pretty much nothing, except that I washed a few dishes, I felt amazing, and it continued for many days after. If you talk to people who do retreats, they will almost always answer that afterwards they experience deep, deep feelings of contentment, connection to others, basically all the stuff we value about being human. In retreats, one practices doing nothing, not thinking. And this is the most profound thing one can do in life, hence the results afterwards. How do we practice doing nothing in life? In everyday life. Well, we certainly need to reserve some time during the day to formally meditate. Sit on a chair or a cushion, sit very still, preferably in some pretzel-like pose, with an upright back. The posture and stillness really helps us to not think. Stilling the body helps to still the mind, because of the connection between the mind and body. If you are young and healthy, I highly recommend you learn to sit in the Four Lotus. I looked it up in Wikipedia, and it is thought this pose encourages relaxation. I also think there's something to do with the way the feet and the hands and the hara, this part, are all like in one place. I don't know, something mystical and magical about that. Maybe it's all in my head, but I... And someone says there's something about the meridians all kind of line up or something. I don't know. Anyway, I like it. It also keeps the body very stable. It's much hard. In other words, it's hard to move it when you're in Four Lotus. It also allows the mind to become very concentrated as well. Even though sitting in Four Lotus is the most painful position, it is also the position that one can cope with the pain the best. However, having said all this, it is not necessary to sit on a cushion. I have met teachers who sit on a chair. I'm pretty sure one teacher I met never ever sat on a cushion. And they were pretty young and they were sitting on a chair. I also highly recommend sitting with others. For most of us, sitting with others is a different experience than sitting alone because of the energy that others bring and you bring. They kind of like build together. It is the difference between watching a sporting event at home or in an arena. Besides meditation, how else can we practice doing nothing? There are many opportunities during the day to do nothing. There are many transition periods during the day when we walk into work, when we walk to the bathroom, when we go to lunch, when we are stopped at the traffic lights. What do we usually do during these times? If we do not have any plan, if there's no structure in place, no habit that we have, what we usually do is think. Or we may be in the habit of listening to music those times or checking our cell phone. A big transition period for many is the time after dinner, before going to bed. I notice that in the evenings I will watch Netflix for an hour or so. Sometimes, though, I just lie on my bed and meditate, and sometimes I sit in a cushion. Often what I notice is how tired I am. As soon as one removes distractions, one becomes in touch with one's body, and it tells you things that you do not notice when you're watching some exciting show on Netflix or doing something exciting. So all of these examples, all of these transition periods, are great opportunities for meditation, for doing nothing. And I highly recommend it. I know the mind kind of thinks, oh, what's the point? That's not going to do anything. We think that doing nothing, that's not going to do anything. It's like somehow we have to do something, I don't know, like we have to accomplish something for it to make a difference. Somehow we've got it in our heads. But really, it's just a very simple practice of doing nothing makes an incredible difference to human beings and the quality of your life. Now, it takes a few weeks to form a new habit. So when you start off, you have to kind of make a commitment to it. You might want to tell people, like, whenever I'm at the traffic lights, I'm going to meditate. I'm just going to stay still and focus on my breath. Whenever I'm at a traffic lights, just tell someone. That helps. Rather than just keeping it in your own head, tell someone what you're going to do. And then they might check up on you. Like a few weeks later, they'll say, how's it going with the traffic light meditation? And you can say, oh, I'm doing pretty good. Or, no, I forgot. It's boring. Anyway, go ahead.
Does that mean you should slow down and it turns yellow?
Say it again?
So when you slow down and it turns yellow, like so you can meditate longer?
So when it's turning yellow and you're slowing down, you should go into meditation right then? Yeah, I try to meditate when I drive, I do. Why wait till the traffic lights? Like I did this retreat. It was down in Southern California. It was like a 9 hour, 10 hour drive. That was about 8 hours, but I stopped, so it was about 10 hours. And I like to drive. I like to sit up right in my seat, hold onto the wheel like this, and get very still, and just meditate as I'm driving. I like to do that. Try it. What else are you gonna do? Listen to the radio. I mean, there might be, I know there's good stuff on the radio, but. Alright. So all of this sounds good, but human beings are very resistant to doing nothing. Even once. Let alone forming habits to do nothing. What, spend most of my day doing nothing? No, that can't be right. I teach at a college, and I notice that when students are on their own, they listen to music. Or they text, or they surf the internet on some electronic gadget, basically filling the space with something, usually something exciting. I also notice that when I'm in the cafeteria, I watch students, and when they're on their own, they'll be eating, but they'll also be doing something else at the same time. I've noticed this. This is kind of strange if you think about it. Eating. Isn't eating one of the great pleasures of being alive? I mean, there is some sadness and some suffering in life, you might have noticed that. Eating is not one of them for most of us. It's for some reason, food. Now I'm going to do something else. More exciting. That's a little strange. Let us examine this resistance that we have. Resistance is the ego, as Eckhart Tolle says. It is the roadblock to just letting life flow through us. Here is a nice example of resistance. A while back, a friend was asking a group of us advice on a personal issue. This person was very intelligent. He actually knew a lot about therapy and all kinds of things like that. This person was trained and educated. All right. So we gave them advice, but it did not seem to satisfy them. Later, I realized that they did not want advice to solve the problem. They could figure that out themselves. They knew what to do. They wanted to know how to remove the resistance to doing what is necessary to solve the problem. And I think that is the crux of most people's problems. Most people can figure out how to solve a problem. The main issue, yeah, I know how to solve it. I just don't want to do it. Right? So what's that? That's the resistance, right? Most people know what to do to lose weight. It's not rocket science. But the problem is the resistance to doing it. One form of resistance is boredom. The other day, my daughter, who is 15, was sitting next to our dog, who was sick. She is better now, so don't worry, she's okay now. And she was stroking the dog. She likes my dog. She was stroking him. In her other hand was a cell phone, and she was watching videos. So I said, why don't you just stroke the dog? Why do you need the cell phone? And she said that that would be boring. I said, and being bored is really bad. She looked at me like I was an idiot. And I asked her on a scale of just a 1 to 10, how bad was being bored? She said, 11. She has my sense of humor. Clearly being bored is very bad and something to be avoided at all costs. Right? Now, when one meditates a lot, as one does in a retreat, what comes up for people, especially in the first few retreats, I'm warning you, if you do a retreat, is boredom. Mind-crushing, soul-destroying boredom. I like to be dramatic. But boredom is not a bad thing. Boredom is one of the gateways to the good stuff. And one has to go through it. When all distractions are removed, as they are at retreats, then one starts to get close to being present and actually doing nothing. This is when boredom arises. This is one of the tricks of the mind. It does not want you to do nothing. It does not want you to be present. One of its tricks is makes you bored. So this is the mind's way of resisting, doing nothing. And it is a pretty effective deterrent for most people. I want to talk now about retreats. So I'm going to say something a little confrontational. So if you want to find out what this Zen practice is really about, you have to do a retreat. And at some point, one longer than 3 days. I know of no way around this. I wish there was a way around it, but I found none. So why do I say why longer than 3 days? It takes 3 days to settle into a retreat. So you want to do a longer one to see what happens afterwards. Because that's when it gets interesting. Sometimes. Not always. Sometimes it's boring the whole way through. If you decide to do a retreat, then I recommend you do the whole thing. Of course, doing part of it is better than nothing, but it is like going to part of a soccer game. You get a feel of what is going on, but you do not get the full experience. Now, I know that people get worried about the pain. We have chairs. You do not have to sit like this the whole time. You can just sit in a chair, so you don't have to, like, go through agony in a retreat. However, no matter what, your first retreat will pretty much be an endurance test. For most people it is. Sorry. Actually, probably the first few of them. I'm putting you off. The vast majority of people will experience crushing boredom and pain in the knees. At the end, right at the end of the first one, you'll probably say, that was hell. I will never do that again. Why did I sign up for that thing? But then, the day after the retreat comes, and you go, oh, wow. You will. You will have your first glimpse into what all the fuss is about, what all the Zen masters were talking about, And it will make it all worth it, and you will be hooked, and you will sign up for more retreats. You have been warned. This oh wow experience is not necessarily an enlightenment experience, like they say in all the books, you know, what they talk about. It's just plain feeling good. You just feel really good after a retreat. Raise your hand if you feel good after a retreat, if you've experienced that. Anybody's done a retreat, feels good. Yeah, see? Talking of enlightenment, a senior monk that I knew said that being enlightened, I'm talking about an enlightenment experience, being enlightened is like some feast that people keep raving about, but it's very far away. You can't see the feast, you can't smell the feast. You just heard about it, just people tell you about it. At first, you read about it. You can read all these books about this feast and how wonderful it's prepared and all the spices and how good it smells and everything about it. And it sounds really scrumptious, but it seems a long way to travel to get to it. Eventually, hopefully, you say, I have to experience this feast that I've heard so much about. So you start meditating. And then occasionally, just occasionally, the wind is in the right direction and you get a faint whiff of the feast. You go, ooh, smells good. Then you do a retreat and the smell of the feast is quite noticeable. After many retreats and practice periods, a practice period is usually a 3-month full-time training at a monastery. So after some retreats and some practice periods, maybe just one, you get your first taste of an hors d'oeuvre at the feast. By the way, in Soto Zen, we do not talk about enlightenment experience much, but Les is not here. I'm going to. But personally, I think they are extremely encouraging. I have studied in the Rinzai school of Zen, as well as the Soto school. So I have some Rinzai training and I can't quite get rid of it. In the Rinzai school, they emphasize having an enlightenment experience called, sometimes called a Kensho in Japanese. However, if you have a Kensho, you still have to practice after such an experience. Otherwise, the experience, it becomes just a nice memory. And there are, I remember I was at Zen Center Los Angeles for about 7 months and we practiced Rinzai Zen as well as Soto Zen. And they told me stories about people who came to meditation retreats, usually young, very young and very open to things, just threw themselves into the retreat and had an experience during the retreat, like a 7-day retreat. They have an experience. But after the retreat, they didn't meditate. They had no formal training in meditation. They knew nothing much about it. And they didn't meditate afterwards. And the experience became just a memory, just a fond memory. So you really have to do both. It's important to do both. Is it necessary to do retreats and practice periods to get to the feast? Theoretically, no. But you better have some other powerful practice in place. I mean, there are some powerful practices on this planet. I have done some. However, Zen practice is pretty darn good. I'm not sure you can beat this. Maybe there is something, but I don't know of it. Personally, I know of no Zen teacher who has not done at least one practice period in their lives. At 3 months full-time training, we do a lot of retreats, and you're doing it 24/7 a day. No distractions. That is very, very powerful for people. It really does rearrange the, I can almost say it rearranges your molecules. It's that level of change. Society seems to encourage us not to do nothing. There are many expressions that seem to promote this, such as, keep your nose to the grindstone. Idle hands are the devil's workshop. How's life? Staying busy? If a lot of people actually enjoyed doing nothing, it would probably be very bad for the economy. Who would buy the motorcycles, the hang gliders, the cell phones, the fancy cars, the expensive houses, the drugs, and the computers? If you watch most large animals, They spend a lot of time doing nothing. I know my dog does. And my cat. So maybe they know something that we do not. And I'm going to end it right there. So how long have we got? What's the time? It's 9:30.
8:30.
Oh, only half an hour. Okay, any questions? Yes, Agatha.
When you reach a limit, is it like you always go back to it, or do you restart over and you reach it again?
Like an enlightenment experience?
Yeah. And is it like every time you meditate, you're like right back there, or is it like, oh, yeah,
no, no. Like, you don't go back. You have to keep practicing. Enlightenment experiences just happen. Just happen. Usually when you're in the middle of a retreat, usually, but not always. Usually when you've been practicing a lot, they just kind of occur. And there are different kinds. Usually, sometimes it's like a small thing. Sometimes it can be just like, oh yeah. But other times it can be like major openings, Eckhart Tolle described one, which is, listen to his, or read his book, The Power of Now.
I have it in my bag,
actually. You have it in your bag, yeah. So he described a pretty powerful opening, like an opening into the nature of reality. And pretty dramatic. Yeah, but they are very encouraging, and you do kind of remember them. You kind of remember the flavor of them, but you don't actually feel the experience of it. It's the experience you can't get to again. So it just happens. But you kind of remember it, kind of a vague recollection of it. Yeah. Yeah, Bonnie.
So you talked about like 3 month practice periods where you're in intense practice, and I'm always looking to understand what is helpful for transitioning back into everyday, fast-paced Silicon Valley, and you're coming from this serene, quiet space, very deep and sensitive, and coming into this like Silicon Valley traffic. Like, have you found any way to ease yourself back in, or to kind of keep that practice? Well, I mean, obviously being here, but you know, what helps that transition?
Well, I've only done one practice. I did 7 months at Zen Center Los Angeles. That was the only practice period I did. It was two. It was kind of a big chunk of one and a big chunk of another. I did, and then there was something in the middle. I didn't really think about it, about how to train. Well, what I did after, so you're asking the wrong person, because what I did was I didn't go to Silicon Valley. I just went to Monterey. And didn't work. I hung out with, I had a girlfriend. So I used to hang out, run by the water, run by the ocean. And, I did handyman work. So that's physical work is good. Physical work and Zen really go well together. Because you're in your body. Your mental work is really, that's really difficult to, I teach, I don't think it's as bad as computer programming. And I find it, really difficult to meditate, to be focused when I'm teaching. I mean, one thing I'll do is, when I'm writing on the board, or when I finish writing and I'm cleaning the board, I'll just clean the board. Like, I'll focus on just cleaning the board, watching my, and everybody goes quiet while I clean the board, just watching me. Look like this. So that's one thing you can do. I also have like a little routine. I come in the class and I put all my things out and I try to focus on, I put the book there, put my pens there, and I try to focus on what I'm doing as I'm putting. So there's like little things you can do during the day to focus on it, to keep your mind and doing nothing. But for going straight back, personally, I would take a vacation after doing a practice period. Yeah, take a couple of days, a couple of weeks off. Yeah, transition. You will probably feel like having a vacation after a practice period. And that vacation will be a great vacation, I assure you. You will know, that will be the greatest vacation you've ever had. You will be like, wow, the sea, oh my God. A flower, oh my God. You'll be like, people will think you're stone or something. Yeah, Travis.
You were talking about other powerful practices. And
yeah.
Here, what?
What have I done?
Yes. What are your other ideas?
Oh, what have I done besides? Good question. All right. Well, I did. I joined this organization called Landmark Education once, and which was started by Werner Erhard. Some of you might have heard of him. He started Yes Training back in the 70s. Which is a pretty powerful program. And I didn't do the Yesh training, but I did like the one that followed that one. It's called the Forum, or the Landmark Forum, it got changed to. And that's it's a three-day program where you sit in a room on chairs, and there's a man at the front called the Forum Leader, or a woman at the front called the Forum Leader, and they produce this powerful course, and you're there for like 50 hours. So you start at 9 in the morning and go to 12 at night. So it's intensive. And basically, it's philosophical. And I always find it very fascinating that this is really, it's a very mental thing, but it's a philosophy, and it's based on, who are the guys? Like, terrible with names. Heidegger. One of those guys. Was it? Yeah, one of those. It's based on the idea of being, on how to, the philosophy of being, like how to be a certain way. Like in Zen, it's something similar. You know, like in most of us have this idea that in life that if you do things, then at the end of it, you'll get stuff. Could be material stuff. Could be a nice wife or husband, children. Could be a lot of things. But if you do things, you will get things, and then you will be able to be happy or be content or be fulfilled. That's how society promotes it, doesn't it? Whereas Zen, and this course is the same thing. No, it doesn't work like that. You have to work on your being first. It's being. I mean, if you think about it, that whole thing about doing all this stuff, to get all this stuff, to be happy, doesn't make sense. I mean, who are the happiest people? Children. I mean, you look at children, they seem to be way happier than I am. Look at my daughter, she doesn't seem to have the issues I have. I mean, she doesn't do much. She certainly doesn't have much, but she's happy. Pretty happy. So, in this Landmark Forum, they say, you know, you work on your being first. And if you work on your being, things will start to come to you. The doing will become more natural. So that's an interesting idea. So there's lots of like kind of ideas like that they have in this Landmark Forum. Things like what are human beings really up to? You know, in Zen they say, well, I have an ego and all that. But like they get down to specifics. Like there's something that all human beings are interested in, not just our little foibles and our little India idiosyncrasies, but there are some things that human beings of all, everybody, across cultures, things like being right. Human beings are very interested in being right. If you really look at it, these things are not on the surface. You kind of have to like think a little bit about it, like notice. So you kind of like, they'll say things like, human beings are very interested in being right. So then they'll say, on the break, notice how you like to be right. So you start to observe how the mind is. You start to notice in many different ways you like to be right and you don't want to be wrong. So things like that. So it was a very powerful insight into the way human beings behave. And it was profound. I mean, afterwards, but it's different. I don't know, it doesn't affect you the same way. You feel good after, but it's not the same as after a Zen retreat. I don't know why. There's a different quality to it. There's a lot of emphasis on communication. So you can go further into this program. There are lots of programs at Landmark Education Office, and you can go further into it. You can like do training programs to become like to teach it, to teach like There's a program to learn how to teach an introduction to the Lambok form, which is a three-hour program. That's all it is. And you can learn how to teach that. And that's like 6 months, 20 hours a week training. It's pretty intense. And I found that very powerful and very confronting. Because what you're doing is you're dealing with people all the time. People. And I found that very difficult. Because I find people difficult. Maybe some of you do. But you're dealing with them in a very... Every time you're dealing with them in a very powerful way. You're having these powerful conversations for making a difference with someone. It's not like everyday conversation. Yeah. So it's very confronting conversations. And it's confronting for them. It's confronting for you. Because stuff comes up about yourself. It's like, whoa, I don't want to see that stuff. So I found it very powerful. Yeah. And the people who lead these things remind me a lot of Zen teachers. They have that kind of quality. I mean, they're just very calm and they're very energetic. And they go through the whole day. They lead this whole course. No, from 9 in the morning to 12 at night, I see no drop off of energy. It's like all the way through the day. So that's one of the practices. And of course, there's other religions, you know, Islam, and they have their own practices. And there's therapy, of course. But I'll get you in a second. But I've never found therapy to be quite as powerful. To me, it's very mental. But I tell you something though, if you mix meditation, really mixes well with a lot of stuff, with a lot of stuff. So if you mix meditation, like you do have a meditation practice, and you do therapy at the same time, that can be very powerful together. In fact, there was a teacher I was talking about the other day. She said she was in this like a group, and the counselor, the therapist said, "You're going way faster than everybody else." It's a little embarrassing to the others, but you're going way faster than everybody else. So she says, "How'd you do that?" And she says, "Well, I have a meditation practice." So it just, this is so, it's so fundamental, Zen practice. It's so bottom line. It will work with anything, as far as I can tell. It gets you the most deepest level that you can go of, as being a human being. Yeah.
Has or was stand up a powerful path?
Say it again.
Has or was your work in stand up a powerful path for you?
You're going to have to speak loud because I'm deaf.
Was your work in stand up being a powerful path for you?
So did you say stand up?
Stand up comedy.
Stand-up comedy. So what about stand-up comedy?
Was it powerful?
Is it powerful? Oh, is stand-up comedy a powerful practice? Is that the question?
Yeah.
Ah! Wow, we got there in the end. I'm sorry, I'm deaf. Stand-up comedy a powerful practice? I'm not sure it's that powerful. It deals with one aspect. You have to overcome... you really get to see how incredibly fearful you are of humanity doing stand-up comedy. I used to do, I did stand-up comedy for about a year. The first 6 months I was getting a routine together. And then what you do, I had a coach, and what you do in stand-up comedy is you go to these clubs, mostly in San Francisco, there's not many around here, but you go to these, they're bars. They're not really clubs, they're bars, and they have they're called open mics. And you go there, and usually you have to pay, which is kind of annoying, but you pay and you do your routine. It's a 5-minute routine. And there are people there, they have no idea who you are, you're not advertised or anything, no one gets there and says, "Okay, give it up for Victor, a great up and coming comic." No, they don't do that. They say, "Okay, it's open mic." And normally someone sounds really bored. And people are like drinking at the bar, you know. And then people are sitting at the table. And you come up and you stand at the back trying to look cheerful. And people are going, "Oh, what the heck is this?" And then you do your routine. Like that. And so the first thing is to get there. It's, "Oh God, I go through such fear." Like I'd be in the car thinking, oh my God, I gotta go to this place. All these strangers. And I gotta do this. And the fear was so intense. But if I manage to get there, and once you start, you're fearful at the beginning, and then you start saying a few things, and usually no one laughs at all. They don't throw anything, luckily for me. They just, there's no laughing, and you just, and then and at some point you go, oh my God, I want to run out of here. You don't want to do things, you don't want to react though. You don't want to, see, that's the Zen training right there, you see. React, most people like to react. So you like go, is this thing on? Like that's reacting, and that's not, that shows a lack of confidence. You don't want to do stuff like that. So you don't react. All you do is just keep going. You keep going through your routine. No matter what's happening, you just keep going, saying your routine. And that's it's like a practice. It becomes like a practice. You're like meditating. You're just going through your routine, and you do it. And then at the end, maybe you get a little slight giggle somewhere or other, and then you leave, and that's it. That's the training. So you're being trained to, you know, to accept anything. You know, I mean, you're basically being, it feels like you're being rejected, which is one of the worst things human beings can suffer, right? Be rejected, be abandoned. So I did it for a year, and then I couldn't do it anymore. I chickened out. I want to get back to it though. I think I'd be much better now. Yeah, I'd like to get back to it. Because, yeah. I really like people laughing. Making people laugh is just an amazing feeling. I don't know what it is. It's like, I think it's power. That's what I think it is. That's all it is. I'm not sure it's a good thing. Like, whoa, I had these people are in my hands, in the palm of my hands. That's the feeling. Like they're going to do. I had that experience. When I was doing this training at one point, I guess I was in a good mood or something. Oh, the audience was the nicer audience. And I started my routine. My routine starts off pretty well. And after about two or three jokes, they were laughing quite loudly. And I was like, I got this feeling. Oh my God. They actually really like me. They love me. And I can do anything. And then all of a sudden I started getting worried. Oh no, it's not going to last. And I went into my head. And then it all went downhill. But just for a few moments. I mean, you know, those stand-up comedians that just keep going for like an hour. That's pretty amazing. The other thing about it is you have to be natural. And that's really hard. I mean, you actually have to act. And, you know, I've done acting as well. And one thing I know about when you act, when you act, you are like pretending to be something, pretending to be have a certain emotion, like that. When you really act well, what happens is it comes from some place, your behavior and the way you speak comes from some other place, comes from Buddha nature, basically. And when it occurs, when that ego disappears, when that roadblock disappears, and all of a sudden it just comes through, and then it's natural. And when you do that, it's an amazing feeling. This is almost like a Kensho. I've done it a couple of times, and when I did it, because I never really got into acting that much, but when I did it, when it just came through like that, it was like, oh my God, who just spoke? Because it didn't feel like me. It felt like someone else. You know, that's the creative, you know, like true artists, you know, that creative experience. True artists will say that. If you read what artists say, they will say that there are moments when things just come through them and they're just not there. And that's when true art happens. That's an amazing experience. I got the second time round. All right.
I didn't know. I'm sorry.
What?
So that kind of made me think about hobbies. Talking about like that. A lot of people say that certain hobbies, like I guess gardening or crocheting, things like that. They say they're very therapeutic.
Right.
They can zone out. They describe it as meditative. But would that be inaccurate then? Because what they're actually doing is zoning out and not necessarily.
Well, I don't.
Is that like kind of counterproductive?
Zoning out is like is basically thinking. So you kind of like you're kind of going on automatic. Like when you drive a car and you're just thinking, you're being on automatic. So that's not meditation. But when you do physical activities like gardening or crocheting, they're more helpful for meditation because you're using your hands, you're using your body. It's much harder to zone out. And also there's not a lot of thought is required, right? You don't actually have to do thinking. It's not like computer program where you actually have to think. No, when you're doing gardening, not much thought is required. I mean, I was doing some gardening today, and I was just separating out carrots. You know, there's not much thought to it. Just, oh, there's a carrot and he's separating. Stick a thing in there, stick in the ground, take it out, put it in there. It's not much thought. So but physical activity is useful to focus on your body and your movement of the body. Yeah. So that's why it's considered therapeutic. But I mean, I guess it's possible to do it and still be totally in your head about it. But I think it's harder. Yeah.
So do you teach your classes like stand-up comedy? And if so, do you find that your students are more engaged?
Do I teach classes in stand-up comedy?
Yeah.
Do I? No, I'm not that good.
Sorry, do you teach your classes like stand-up?
Ah! yeah, I was throwing a few jokes, yeah. Especially at the beginning, when I teach mathematics. So mathematics is a pretty serious subject. And also, I think people are very scared of it. So I try to get them to relax. And also, I have a very serious demeanor. I think it's my Englishness. Yeah. At least that's my excuse. I think it's more than that, but anyway. But so, I try to smile as much as possible. I try to tell jokes and smile so I don't seem come across as so serious. Yeah.
It's just crazy
because
you smile.
What?
You just come across as a little crazy because you're talking
about smiling all the time. Sometimes I do that in the middle of the class. I'll say something and I think, that was a little harsh. And then I'll go, and they all laugh. But I do have a few jokes, especially at the first class. I have some jokes. And then later on, they kind of die out. I need to come up with some better material. Come up with some new material, I think.
I went to a, it was not an open mic, it was more like a poetry night. People would recite, and I had written something that I thought was very funny, and I started reading it, and it was very quiet. Nobody laughed at all. And then I realized that I'm reading this in a very serious, like, I'm reading it so seriously.
Right.
So I just mentioned, you know, this is supposed to be funny. And then everybody started laughing all of a sudden.
Yeah.
It was hard. There's a difference between what it meant to me, but maybe my delivery was too dour. What you mentioned earlier about entering the zone of, I played in a blues band for about 5 or 6 years in Santa Cruz. And the first couple of years, you know, we tried hard, we were just like a house band. But then we started getting much better, tighter band. And there were times where the music just sort of happened.
Yeah.
You're kind of inside, you get inside the music.
Yeah.
And it's hard to explain. It's a feeling like, it's just happening.
Yeah, yeah. You're not there. Kind of like you're kind of there, but not there. Kind of going through, isn't it? Mm-hmm. I had another little share. When I first started teaching, I remember that when I was being trained as a teacher, people used to say, this is how they train. They say, okay, you got to do this, you got to do this, you got to do this. That's how people are trained, right? Do this, do this, do this. So I would do those things and it wouldn't work. And then they say, do this. And I try that, it wouldn't work. And they say, do this, and it wouldn't work. And I began to figure out the problem was not what I was doing. It was the way I was being when I was doing them. Being is far more important than what you're doing. You know, there are you can have two people do exactly the same thing, and they'll get a totally different result. They can say the same thing, say it in the same way it appears to be, but they will get a different reaction or a different result because of the way they're being. And I was being, when I first started teaching, I was being very fearful and very wanting to control, to got a certain result. Once I started relaxing, which took a lot, people, at some point someone said, people kept telling me, some people started saying, why don't you use your sense of humor in a classroom? Because that's one of your strengths. And I kept saying, no, 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 no. You can't do that in a classroom. They'll walk all over you. You don't understand. These kids are animals. I taught junior high for a while. So, what was I going to say? So I said, so, but then I had the courage and I said, okay, I'll do it. So I started, I told one joke tentatively and they all laughed and I told a few more and it got a good response. And I started doing more and more and eventually everything turned around in my teaching. They started to like me. Whereas before, it was always like they were against me. It was me against them. And there was more of them. So that, yeah, turned around. So
you should have an objective point of view.
That what?
That they were against you.
I think that's pretty true. No. No. No, some of them were. No, some of them were for me. I think they took. Someone took pity on me. Someone used to come out to me afterwards and say, don't let them get you down, Mr. Lair. You're doing a good job. And I kept, yeah, right. I have some funny stories about teaching. How long have we got?
Very close.
I tell you one funny, I have to tell a few funny stories. That I was teaching this junior high school in Gilroy. It had gang students. It was a junior high, had gang students. Anyway, so... I taught math, and there was this friend of mine who used to teach math, and he was right next door to me. And the door opened out onto the playground, and so we'd teach, and then there was a break, right? So we teach two classes or three classes, I can't remember, three classes, and then there was a break. And then when the bell went and they all disappeared, we'd both come out of the classroom and we kind of like stagger out. And then collapse against the wall. How's it going? It's hell. That was funny. And then there was, and then halfway through the school year, this new guy came, and you could tell he was he was young, and he was like fresh and excited about teaching. It's going to make a difference with all these kids. He came in and we looked and my friend and I looked at each other. It's like lambs to the slaughter, isn't it? Lamb to the slaughter. Anyway, that has nothing to do with my talk. This is funny. Time to end it. Oh, I was having fun. All right, what are we doing now? Oh yeah, we do something. Do one of those. Then. All right, aren't we doing? We have to introduce ourselves. So anybody new? Who's here for the first time? Please say your names.
Julie.
Julie, right? Julie at the back, right there. Agatha.
Kyle.
Anybody else new?
You are.
I'm new. Yeah, always new. New. Huh? So let's introduce ourselves. I'm Victor.
Jazz.
Todd.
Dimitra.
Sunia.
No.
Ross.
Dicker.
Ken.
Vishnu.
OJ.
Travis.
Tyson.
Richard.
Lee.
Fanny.
Corey.
Umar's at the back. He's being casual.
Umar in the back.
Umar at the back. Now what do we do? Oh yeah, announcements. Any announcements?
I think we're going to be doing the
Saturday meeting,
right?
Before
the
Saturday.
Huh?
Before the Saturday.
Yeah. Is it this Saturday?
I think so.
Yes.
What are we doing?
Sangha meeting this Saturday.
Sangha meeting.
Oh, Sunday. Well, Sunday.
No,
Saturday.
Saturday.
10:30. So 10:30 we're going to do the Sangha meeting. Sangha meeting is where we hold it in the back house. 10:30. It's about the work in the condo, how we run this place. It's run by all of us. There are no outsiders. There are no outside influences. It's just all of us have different roles. If you would like to come and find out a little bit more and get a little bit more involved, yeah, you can do that. Otherwise, you know, we have the regular Saturday schedule, which starts at 5:30 in the morning and goes till 10 o'clock, 10:10, and then you can go home. It's like a half a day retreat, right?
Half a day or almost.
Yeah.
Yeah, I highly recommend coming to the Saturday thing. Good, I'm glad you mentioned that.
Yeah.
Come to the Saturday, do the whole thing from 5:30 all the way through, can go through 12, right?
Yeah.
Or even late 12:30.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So,
it's like a little mini retreat.
It's like a mini retreat.
Yeah, why not, eh? What else you got going on? Nothing.
Yeah.
You know it. At the last.
Do we have any special projects this Saturday? Do we?
Is
that it? Any more announcements? All right. Oh, so afterwards we're going to do a little mini chant, and then we go down there if you want to and have tea and cookies, and I'll tell you some of my stand-up routine if you ask nicely. Say please. I'm kidding. All right. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. The Buddha's way is unsurpassed. I vow to end it. I'll turn this thing off.